Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. By the end of the police siege in Hong Kong's Polytechnic University, students were crawling through sewers this week, jumping from a bridge, tunneling under barriers to get free. Not to surrender exactly, or to flee, as one student said, just to get out of a hole that's getting deeper and more dangerous. The fight for almost 6 months now has been to preserve a measure of self-rule. In the sometime British Crown colony that reverted to China two decades ago, under a formula of one country with two systems of governance. But armed battle has now preempted a political argument. Bows and arrows, then firebombs showed up in the hands of the opposition. Facing water cannons and storms of tear gas from the police, no Red Army tanks yet, as in Tiananmen Square 30 years ago, but a popular protest movement is on the defensive and crackdown is in the air. Jeremy Barmé is our guest this hour to reintroduce us to China in real time. He's a great favorite among China watchers around the world. Australian by birth, hooked on China in his teens, steeped in the ancient texts, with a native's command by now of Chinese vernacular languages. Historian, filmmaker, tireless traveler in China over the years, Jeremy Barmé, we are honored to welcome you. What are we looking at? What should we be learning in the fire and brimstone of Hong Kong?
Oh, Chris, what should we be learning? Are we not facing a Chinese extinction rebellion? The young people of Hong Kong are taking the lead. Mm. The city is in open rebellion. It's a Hong Kong uprising. It has been not stage managed, but mishandled by the Hong Kong government with Beijing's complicity to turn popular protests over legitimate complaints into a citywide rebellion against China itself. It's an extraordinary development. It's one of great significance for China. It's also one of significance for the world, because this is one of those young rebellions where young people, feeling hopeless not only about where they live but about the fate of humanity as a whole, have taken the future into their own hands, knowing full well it may well lead to disaster.
It's the yellow vest era almost everywhere. Not almost everywhere, but lots of symptoms. What would the pragmatic alternative approach from Beijing have been? Is there a way? Was there a way out?
Well, you're not really asking the right person, Chris, because in March 1979, 40 years ago, I began to realize that I, as an individual, and those of us involved with China, would be facing a long-term autocratic regime in China. This is 40 years ago.
Pre-Tiananmen.
Long, 10 years before Tiananmen. Some of us have just seen the makings of this present long ago. Hong Kong's fate was determined in the joint agreement of 1984 between China and the United Kingdom, in which no Hong Kong people played a role. They were not allowed to participate in the discussions. They were not allowed to have a voice in their own future. And the agreement that was reached in 1984 is not, in essence, similar from another crucial agreement that has been recalled this year. That agreement made between Beijing and the government in Lhasa, Tibet, in 1951, called the 17-Point Agreement, which led to, because of the Communist Party's constant incursions in Tibet, its betrayal of the 17 points led to, in 1959, a citywide and then territory-wide rebellion against China, one that's now being marked 60 years later by tragedy. Hmm. Now, the 17-Point Agreement of Tibet and the joint agreement between Britain and the People's Republic of China bear a lot of similarities. And now we're seeing the fate of that 84 agreement playing out in the streets of Hong Kong in the most violent and terrifying manner.
By the numbers and the acreage, Hong Kong is small compared to what's going on in Xinjiang, but sounds like a similar pattern of crackdown. The New York Times broke off a huge scoop of Chinese documents, merciless repression of the Muslims and Uyghurs in northwest China, put that in your picture?
Well, you, Chris, or we, non-mainland Chinese people, may well speak of repression. From the point of view of the Chinese Communist Party and a lot of people in China, this is what is unfolding is reasonable, rational, and long-term sustainable re-education and re-tempering of a society so it can better manage a powerful and prosperous future.
Yeah, and they call Xinjiang a triumph of anti-terrorism.
Anti-terrorism and re-education and realignment. Now, we should realize this is the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. What most people aren't aware of, after the founding in 1949, 1950, 1, 2, 3, and 4, the Chinese Communist Party launched a nationwide re-education campaign in which they taught the recently liberated Chinese how to be good citizens under the Communist Party. Mm. What's been happening in Xinjiang, what will happen in Hong Kong if the Communist Party has its way, and there's no reason to think it won't, is the re-education and tempering of those people to suit the rule of the Communist Party. So by saying such, we're saying that Xinjiang is now going through what China itself went through, the mainland of China went through in the 1950s and again more recently, and Hong Kong, the communists have just warned 2 weeks ago. They said Hong Kong needs to go through a period of re-education, patriotic re-education and realignment so as to appreciate its position within the greater context of the motherland of the People's Republic of China. Mm. That's what's unfolding.
Okay. I may be typical of generally informed Americans in being surprised by this turn. I would have said there were lots of moments over the last decade, even 5 years ago, visiting China, when you could imagine that the giant difference between us and them was the difference between a pragmatic nation and a global ideological empire. They're the pragmatic nation. They build subways and universities and long-range trains in China and around the world, or a lot of it. And while we, chase freedom, liberation wars in places like Iraq, we're still in Afghanistan on an idea that we're liberating something. When did China drop the pretense of a working, people-serving, popular engineer government?
It hasn't. In no way has it done so.
It hasn't dropped the pretense.
It hasn't dropped that pretense at all. It is the Chinese government itself does emphasize ideology in to an extent more than it did in the past. But the basic underpinnings of the Chinese Communist Party have not fundamentally changed since 1989 in any substantive way. Xi Jinping's regime has given them more edge, more point, more policy relevance to what he and his colleagues regard as being the crises facing China. But in the broader context, America and China share a great deal in common. You're all consumers. You're all eating up the world. And this you share with each other and you must face together. However, the ideological differences at the moment over trade, over politics, over regional power, over domination, over concepts of what is freedom and what is not freedom is extreme. We're entering, well, in my opinion, we've been in this sort of chilly war environment for a very long time indeed. The Xi Jinping government has brought it to the forefront, and Hong Kong has become a flashpoint that really lights up all the problems facing both China and the West's engagement with China.
Unfold that flashpoint. Surely China, Beijing knows there's a risk here and they know there's a apparent betrayal of their commitment to some sort of loose, peculiar, individual Hong Kong regime, corresponding also to commitments to Taiwan. One nation, several paths. What's the risk for Beijing here?
Well, and this is one of the great debates that's occurring within the Chinese intellectual community in China itself, surreptitiously and underground, and the broader Chinese community globally, which is, has Xi Jinping and his government become too cocky, too hubristic, and have they tried to advance their agendas so quickly as they're actually resulting in exactly the opposite of what they want to achieve? Mm. And at the moment in Hong Kong, we're seeing just that. Many of the things that have risen, exploded in our faces in the last 6 months were problems already exacerbated over the last 20 years, but in particular that came to the fore in 2014 with the Umbrella Movement and further exacerbated by Beijing's mishandling of its own avowed agreement with the British government and with the consensus reached with the Hong Kong people. They've betrayed their own agreement, which has led to this uprising, and now the only way they can see out of the problem is by repression.
My friend and yours, Bill Kirby, China scholar at Harvard, wrote a book with a sort of cheeky title, I thought, 5 years ago, and it was Can China Lead? And the thought was, of course they can, but it will be something like, more like Singapore than what we're seeing in Hong Kong, a loose rein Chinese culture, but a lot of experimentation, a lot of popular input, but first-class services in the nature of infrastructure, subways, that sort of thing. Can China lead? Does China think it's leading? Does it know the downside of today's events?
Indeed. Well, the Chinese authorities would argue that they require social stability. Therefore, they must quell the problems in Xinjiang and make the mainland of China, the China proper, safe for its citizens. They believe that their long-term global policies, the One Belt, One Road infrastructure building project and investment bank projects, appeal to other countries, not the American empire or its allies, but in the long run that these will be popular and supported. They do not believe that they lack the charisma, the cultural aplomb, or the long-term support of peoples around the world. And because they have a system that feeds back things that they want to hear to themselves, they're not very good at correcting their perceptions of where they're going. So that's a huge problem for all of us.
Well, I know. I mean, tone deafness is not...
unique.
Exactly. But are they missing something? Are they not hearing something from the world?
Well, as we see with Hong Kong, they're not hearing what's going on in Hong Kong. And every step they've taken in the last 6 months has been a misstep, further exacerbating the problems. And in the long run, they have created out of the young people of Hong Kong, people from the age of 10 upwards to the age of the mid-30s, they've created two or three generations of rebellious young people. And this cannot be resolved in the next couple of years or through an education campaign. This is what they've done through their mishandling of things. Similarly, in their dealings with America at the moment, the negotiations aren't going all that well over the trade war. China's involvement in other parts of the world are at times problematic. They are experiencing, on one level, to put a positive spin on it, are they not experiencing the perils of empire? Learning how to be not only a global citizen, but how to be a global existence, a global empire. And this is, as you know, the Americans had a very hard time learning it and have failed egregiously again and again and again. So why should the Chinese be any different?
Jeremy Barmé is a scholar familiar in minute detail with the geography, the language, the history, the thinking of China over the ages, an Australian now in exile in New Zealand. Coming up, student visions of China and strategies for Hong Kong next. This is Open Source. China's Communist Party rule reveals itself anew on its 70th birthday. The defining events are unfolding in hard-to-absorb Hong Kong and the Far West ethnically Uyghur and Muslim provinces of the Far Northwest. Frances Hui joins us from Hong Kong. She's a student, sometime in Boston, who's been in the thick of the protest and police siege this past week at Hong Kong's Polytechnic University. Frances Hui, welcome. Give us a postcard of what you've seen this week.
Yeah, I just came back to Hong Kong on Monday, and right after I landed, I went to one of the protests close to the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, and a lot of the students and protesters were stuck in that university, and a lot of people outside were trying to like go into the campus to save them. But obviously, we didn't succeed, and a lot of people still get hurt. Tear gas was being used, and there are still students who are in the campus and are not able to come out. And like right now in the school, there isn't enough food and resources or like any first aid resources that are available for them, and it's just a very, you know, urgent situation right now for them.
Frances, the students, yeah. A lot of students left the university grounds, but the movement didn't surrender. Did it survive? Does it go forward?
So a lot of the people in the campus try to escape using any method they can. And like some other people who are not able to escape are still stuck in there, and then they basically tell the public that they rather, you know, stay there instead of surrender. So they say, like, they'd rather die in the campus instead of, like, you know, surrender to the police because they think that they did nothing wrong. And I think a lot of people, because coming up, we have Election Day on Sunday.
Yes.
And so this movement is totally not ending.
Frances, this has been a popular protest for months now. Is it still?
Yeah. At first, you know, the protest started, the movement started with, you know, only people asking for the withdrawal of the bill. And then right now, moving on, like, people asked for the 5 demands. And now we got people asking for an extra demand, which is the reform of the Hong Kong police force. And a lot of the people are kind of driven by police brutality. And I don't see any chances that people are going to give up or any chances that this movement is going to end without any resolvement about the police brutality, the problem.
Frances, I'm wondering, what is in it for the mass of Hong Kongers? Peace or protest or tweaking, adjusting Hong Kong's peculiar identity as people? Not Brits, not Chinese exactly, but Hong Kongers. What's at stake for everybody?
Yeah, I think the kind of identity as a Hong Konger is very special, and it's kind of rooted in every single Hong Kong people. And I think the reason why people think they are, like, the reason why this kind of unique identity evolved or, like, grow into everyone's heart is because the identity as, like, a Chinese doesn't really represent us. And a lot of people feel like saying that we're Hong Konger, it's, like, so different from saying that we're Chinese, because it says that we know, like, we pursue democracy and human rights, and we know what it means to be free. And so a lot of people are seeing the kind of identity as a Hong Konger is slowly getting control by the Chinese government, as we are seeing what's happening in our home city. Yeah.
Frances Hui, thank you. Jeremy Barme, how much of all of this is a question, are questions of identity, the peculiar self-image of Hong Kongers versus being ordinary Chinese?
Well, indeed, I was fortunate enough to first go to Hong Kong when I was 20 years old, and I worked there from my 23rd year after finishing university in mainland China. And I experienced, and I became a writer in Chinese in the Hong Kong world in the 80s and have been dealing with Hong Kong for my whole adult life. It's a unique part of the Chinese world, the Chinese Commonwealth, a place that has inherited some of the best things of the tradition, the modern world. The British, relatively hands-off colonial administration, allowed a flourishing of a unique kind of identity that we now identify, say, as Hong Konger. It's one that is rooted in Chinese language, in global practice. It's one that's created a unique global cinema, a type of cuisine that's also gone worldwide, and an attitude and worldliness that combines West and East Chinese traditional modern and postmodern in a very unique mix, along with the basic concerns for rule of law, for basically a stable, respectful society that is aware of individual rights and freedoms. And this is something that, in fact, all Chinese I know all aspire to. But for Hong Kong to be acting as it is now makes many people I know in China furious, because they feel deep down ashamed and outraged that they can't have these things. And therefore, many people I know say, why should those in Hong Kong have them?
It sounds like a mass of lovely things to be preserved for the world. And it served an independent or British Hong Kong, shall we say, served mainland China well over many years as not only a banking and trading place, but as a cultural outlet. Could you imagine, could you design a rapprochement, a modus vivendi of a Hong Kong identity in the larger nation of China?
Well, relatively speaking, the Chinese, for all of its faults, the joint agreement with Hong Kong could have allowed this. And that's why they're breaking. The Communist Party's breaking of that agreement has been such a disaster for Hong Kong and for China as a whole over the long run. Could one design a better future? Well, indeed, In fact, all of China's provinces and big cities are all in many regards like Hong Kong, with their own individual cultures and languages and ideas and aspirations that could form part of this a wonderful Chinese Commonwealth. But the Communist Party reasserting highly centralized, monopolistic rule is making that extremely difficult at the moment. And that's why Hong Kong is a threat on many levels. Another aspect of the problem with Hong Kong is that it has also been a place where people have escaped from mainland political repression and idiocy for 70 years. And it's a city that's full of people who are, by their nature, rebellious against the mainland because of what the mainland has done in misruling its own people.
Here's another big picture question, but it was suggested to me both by Ai Weiwei, the great artist, and the novelist Yu Hua. Built into Chinese culture, maybe psychology, is the way around. They're used to breaking rules. They love breaking rules. Yu Hua's little picture was going into a hotel room in China, and sign on the wall says, no smoking. And on the desk is a gift package of cigarettes and an ashtray. So you figure it out, people, and find your own way. Ai Weiwei has been doing it for a lifetime. What's the possibility of that kind of thing being still thriving and even being tolerated? This eccentricity of particular places, particular people.
Well, the Communist Party, as it's presently constituted under Xi Jinping, does not want any of that. It wants to be a modern, highly effective surveillance state and surveillance capitalist type of state. That's what it wants to achieve.
Milton Friedman plus Lenin.
Exactly. And it wants to wipe out as much of that arrant, slightly anarchic, fun side of the Chinese world as it can, while pretending to be uniquely Chinese. That's one of the great paradoxes of contemporary China. Regardless, the basic obstreperous, semi-anarchic, playful and undermining nature of Chinese people is not going to be repressed. It won't change. I lived through the last years of the Cultural Revolution. Even at the height of Maoism, it didn't work. Why would it work now under Xi Jinping and his austere and dull regime?
You tell a wonderful story about Mao in the 1940s, thinking he had broken this hex of repression, conformity, and downfall. Relate that and how it applies to today, if it does.
So this is a period in 1943, 44, 45, when the Communist Party had occupied this guerrilla war base that was fighting the Japanese and also at the time in collaboration with the Nationalist or KMT Party. And Mao and his colleagues felt that they were on the verge of not only launching a civil war, but they had a great chance of winning the whole of China. And in that process, they wanted to convince intellectuals, media people, and others that they could be a responsible and modern Chinese government that would offer hope, democracy, and freedom to China. So they entertained in Yan'an, in the far western part of China, they entertained visitors from the wartime capital of the nationalists and said that we here in Yan'an have come up with a way to overcome all of the legacies of the dynastic past, all the authoritarian behavior of our ancestors, because we believe that consulting with the people, engaging with people's needs, and a form of democracy that we're pursuing will bring a brighter future to China.
Did he use an equivalent word to democracy?
He used the word for Minzhu, which is the people will be in charge. Now, one should remember, the Communist Party from 1944, this period, to 1949, in all of its public statements in China and to the West at the time, promised a number of things. When we get into power from the Civil War, we will introduce universal suffrage, we will protect basic human rights, we will respect democracy, we'll be a progressive, modern nation. They stated this. All of this material was published in a collective form 20 years ago by a wonderful journalist. The book was immediately banned because these statements by the party over a six-year period are now all unsayable.
The non-quotations from Chairman Mao.
These are the same types of things they promised Hong Kong as part of the joint agreement in 1984. And it's the reneging of that agreement in 2014 in particular that has led to today's impasse.
And of course, Mao, in his own time, reneged. And Xi Jinping is the new Mao. Nothing like Mao until Xi Jinping, chairman for life, and he means it. What's his notion of breaking that pattern? It's certainly not democracy yet.
Well, you see, he's referred to the very same things that Mao spoke about in 1944. And on the 1st of October this year, Xi Jinping published an article in which he said, "We continue the tradition of Mao. We have broken the dynastic cycle. We have broken away from the autocracy of the past. We are truly democratic. We are self-correcting, self-perfecting as a system. We are superior to all other political systems in the world. We are a model for all. We are inaugurating a new age of China." 中国之治, it's called. And he and his comrades believe this stuff. Whether you like it or not, they believe it. Bad news for everybody.
What does it mean, a new age for China? What, we hear China Dream and all these other sort of hallmark slogans. But what does he mean?
Well, he means that we believe that after all the experiences of these 70 years of political change and turmoil and also reform and modernization, we have developed a system that is self-correcting and self-modulating, and that we can, no matter what problem we encounter, we can adjust our system collectively under the leadership of the Communist Party to continue to achieve perfection. Unlike that messy America, unlike those disorganized Europeans, unlike the failing state of the United Kingdom, we alone can move towards a greater and better unified future. Now, that is a future in which individual aspiration must be subordinated at every point to the so-called China Dream, which is the dream of the Communist Party and of global preeminence and military power and authority and economic prosperity. Now, they argue we will be a peaceful regime, we'll be a Pax Sinica, we'll be introduce a new age of peace and prosperity for the world.
But we know they've taken a turn. I mean, ordinary people, Chinese people, tell me, teachers, intellectuals, writers, that they're seeing a new face of this government, aided, of course, by, you know, what do we call them, you know, bio-identifiers, irises, surveillance of every kind, crackdown on dissenters. What really has changed, and why, do you suppose?
Well, and over the last many decades, there have been a number of trajectories at work. There have been inflection points where there's been some hope of meaningful change and constitutional reform and a gradual loosening. There's been inflection points that favor more autocracy. Xi Jinping himself is playing a very crucial role. He believes he is an agent of history. He believes that he has a unique role in maintaining party power, and only through maintaining a monolithic control of China can the party not only stay in power, not just that, but that it can achieve the aims of a greater national prosperity. And it believes that's what everybody must be subordinated to. He believes he's working for the greater good. And Wes, you know, those with a missionary zeal who believe they're working for the greater good often create the worst disasters for everybody.
This is the view that Mikhail Gorbachev wimped out in Russia. He didn't take charge of his own party, his own geography, and there it goes.
And the Chinese argue that, and Xi Jinping has spent a lot of money getting researchers and others to work out exactly what happened in the Soviet Union, with the aim of making sure it doesn't happen in China, that we do not want to go down that road because we, the Communist Party, are the ultimate good for China and everybody here. Okay, you might not agree. Well, I'm going to impose it on you anyway.
It's always fascinating for Americans to see these sort of general ratings by Chinese people of their government. It's much more popular than our government is year in, year out, decade in, decade out. Do you believe that, or is that a polling trick?
Well, I know about it, and I know many people in China who've prospered wonderfully under these conditions. I belong, as an individual, I mean, I can't really speak on behalf of anybody but myself, I belong to that arrant, obstreperous kind of radical, quasi-anarchic individualism, and which is a grand tradition within China as well, and that's what I relate to. Therefore, I'm not the best person to ask that question of.
Your model is a dissident law professor in Beijing, I think, Xinhua, who has just been, in effect, given notice that his time is up. Take that apart. He's your kind of guy, and there are lots of them with the Chinese rebellious, independent, mischievous, critical spirit. What's the fate of people like that? And the larger question is, what restraints does Xi Jinping, what outside views of himself and what he's doing is he open to? But back to the dissenter.
Well, this dissenter is, in fact, referring to a professor of law, a very famous professor of law at Tsinghua University, China's second most important university, a man by the name of Xu Zhangrun, who in July last year published a massive critique of the Xi Jinping government, first in China, in the mainland, and then internationally. And I ended up translating this long thing. It's all available if you're interested on ChinaHeritage.net.
Wonderful site, may I say.
Thank you so much. As of many other of Xu Zhangrun's work. Now, Xu Zhangrun is an establishment intellectual. He's not a dissident, but he's a person of great moral probity, and he's a person who's given voice to many of the types of disquiet held by people throughout China, professionals, academics, thinkers, business people, and others. This is not some arrant, strange, anarchic voice like mine. This is the voice of moderate reform and change that's looking towards a better, more stable, sustainable future for China that's not only determined by one-party autocracy. And his critiques and comments are much lauded around the Chinese world. He was, of course, because he criticized Xi Jinping directly and outlined all of these comments about corruption and party ineptitude and the One Belt, One Road and all the rest of it, was put under investigation, banned from publishing. He kept on publishing in Hong Kong. He's just published another piece in Hong Kong recently. He's been told that his fate will be determined very soon. But nonetheless, he's giving voice to this concern that only with China advancing along a constitutional path, including obeying the agreements that's come to over Hong Kong and developing its own constitution and limiting term limits, like Xi Jinping's terminal tenure, will China have any chance of really becoming a modern, equitable global citizen?
Interesting questions. Will we hear them from him into the future, do you think?
Well, nobody knows. At the moment, he's banned from writing any further. He's just sent a new book down to Hong Kong. He's waiting an adjudication from the highest authorities in China as to whether he'll lose his job and be silenced permanently. We simply don't know.
Jeremy Barme is our friend of dissidents in China, friend of China going back thousands of years. Coming up, China on the Brink. This is Open Source. A defining moment in China is upon us, but what will it be? In Hong Kong? In the Uyghur Northwest? In a seething world? Wilfred Chan joins us from New York, Hong Kong-born and active in the collective of Chinese writers and thinkers trying to find Hong Kong's path between colonial exceptionalism and the boot heel of Beijing. Wilfred Chan, welcome. Describe the thinking, the strategic thinking, near and far, in your movement.
Yeah. So I think we have to have an analysis of why Hong Kong has this paradoxical form of governance in which it has the trappings of a sovereign state, but none of the autonomy. And you have to understand that Hong Kong has, from the get-go, been an interface for a Western style of trade and now neoliberal globalism. And, the interests of Chinese elites, now a form of authoritarian state capitalism.
And what's wrong with that, in a sense? I mean, it's been a boom town all my life.
Sure. And, this results in a form of state business collusion that makes this possible. And for the average Hong Konger, that means that 20% of people in Hong Kong are living under the poverty line. It means Hong Kong has the highest Gini coefficient, measure of inequality in the developed world, the highest rents in the developed world that an average university graduate has to save for decades just to afford a down payment. And then when you look at how Hong Kong's legislature and electoral system is designed to basically be picked by the people who are benefiting from this system, you start to see a lot of parallels to the forms of exploitation that we see elsewhere in the capitalist world.
Describe a path, Wilfred, between neoliberalism on a global scale and the harsh, sometimes brutal rule of Beijing.
Well, and the whole point is that right now there is not a great path. So, to the extent that Hong Kongers are unwilling to let go of this fantasy of a, post-Cold War free market world peace, it's really because there is no viable alternative right now. You know, you see that Hong Kongers are attempting in many ways, maybe without even articulating it, to develop forms of mutual aid, develop new forms of organization, of community in the streets, in the protests. But, you know, this is a prefigurative politics that isn't something that can really, you know, disentangle Hong Kong from these empires that it's historically been ensnared within.
Wilfred, what are the tactics that have been working in the last 6 months, and which ones have not? What are you learning?
I mean, Hong Kongers have made history. The fact that this leaderless, decentralized movement has been able to really resist the best efforts of a government as powerful as, you know, China's is really something. But I think that we can see that Hong Kongers simply aren't going to win this street fight in the long run. And that's because the state is always going to have better resources, is going to outlast you. And, you know, my own friends are out there on the streets getting traumatized. You know, they're exhausted. And so we have to find a new way to broaden this movement and to find other sources of leverage against the enemy.
I was going to say, who has leverage on Xi Jinping in this situation? In the world community, in the business community, in Hong Kong itself? Who's restraining him? And they haven't done in Tiananmen Square yet. What is the restraint in the world, in China, in Hong Kong, on the heavy hand of the Red Army or Xi Jinping?
You know, again, we have to look at the way that China needs Hong Kong in many ways. It doesn't need it as much as maybe in the 20th century for trade, but it still badly relies on Hong Kong for outbound direct investment, for the for its own elites investments in Hong Kong real estate. And I, you know, sadly, I feel that this is one of the main reasons that China hasn't actually rolled in the tanks, is this cold sort of self-interest. Now, you know, when you look at it that way, you see that the West really doesn't have too dissimilar of a logic when it comes to Hong Kong. You know, they might espouse the rhetoric of human rights and democracy and freedom, but in reality, no one is interested in seeing Hong Kong, you know, enjoy full autonomy to really chart its own path, because that would make it less useful to the global system, you know, in terms of being this loophole and interface between these two hegemonies of capitalism.
Well, for Chen, I want to ask Jeremy Barme, do you see a path of reconciliation or a way to continue in peace with gestures of semi-sovereignty in Hong Kong, Jeremy?
No.
No. if Xi Jinping saw one, would he take it? I guess the answer would be no, too.
No.
Explain that. Explain your no and what you think is ahead.
Well, Wilfred's touched on the very core of the issue, and that is, you know, the imperia, the imperial powers that exist today don't want Hong Kong to be, well, either have a reconciled position of a semi-autonomous nature or to be independent in any way. It's a useful tool within this whole global neoliberal setup. For the Chinese, for the Communist Party in China, Hong Kong's obstreperousness, its uniqueness, its and what it's shown through this mass movement of collective protest and communitarian behavior are terribly threatening. They're all the types of things that the communists might espouse themselves, but they find completely invidious if they develop autonomously among people who are also ethnically Chinese. This is extremely is unacceptable in the extreme.
So what do they do?
Well, they won't. You know, I've never thought they'd be sending in the army. They can use long-term, limited forms of police martial law and long-term control. They have said, as of early November, we will have to carry out massive re-education campaigns in Hong Kong. We will have to introduce massive rafts of new security legislation to repress things in every level of a society. And we will gradually now believe we must transform Hong Kong into being a true part of the greater Da Ya Wan region of which Hong Kong will eventually be subsumed into.
You got to take that word re-education apart. That's what we're hearing about the Uyghurs too. And we know it, of course, from the Cultural Revolution. It translates as brainwashing or some sort of numbing of the human being.
It's like learning a Catholic a catechism. It's learning the lines. It's learning to be hypocritical and betray whatever you are as an individual for the sake of the so-called collective and the sake of so-called political stability and economic prosperity. That's what it's about. We're educated, of course, in a different system within a highly metricized type of educational system in the consumerist society. It's the same type of thing with an order of formal indoctrination that's far more obvious.
Do you know re-education when you see it, Wilfred?
You know, there's been efforts to do that already in Hong Kong. In 2012, the National Moral and Education System is really what kickstarted this generation of student activism, including, you know, that was Joshua Wong's first successful campaign, which, of course, led to his leadership in the Umbrella Movement, which is where I began to report on Hong Kong. You know, all these things run together, and Hong Kongers are definitely aware of what's happening in mainland China with regard to re-education.
Students, of course, are the future and the prize in this battle. What do they want in terms of, I mean, the protesters, but also ordinary young people growing up in Hong Kong? What do they want in terms of Chinese-ness, worldliness?
Well, I think that this is still an open question. You have slogans like Liberate Hong Kong and Free Hong Kong, but it's unclear exactly what a free Hong Kong would look like or what we are trying to be liberated from. You know, that same slogan can even be translated as Restore Hong Kong. So what are we trying to restore to exactly?
Give it back to the Brits, mean?
Right. And, you know, I think that we have to really sort through some of these tricky questions. You know, there is definitely a building sense of a Hong Konger identity, as Francis pointed out, a sort of exceptional notion of Hong Kongers. But I think that even this can sometimes be a bit limiting in terms of how we imagine ourselves in relation to these systems that aren't just going to go away.
How does the chief executive of the Hong Kong government, Carrie Lam, manage this herself? She is a walking embodiment of Hong Kongism, no, Jeremy? I mean, she has had a brilliantly successful Hong Kong career, but she seems to be folding under pressure from Beijing. What role is she looking for in human history?
Well, I doubt she's folding under pressure from Beijing. I believe she's a fervent Catholic. She was well known as being a very self-important high school student. I have friends who went to school with her. And she's probably a secret party member. I think that she can combine the hypocrisy of Catholicism with the hypocrisy of communism very easily in herself.
Wilfred?
Carrie Lam definitely does embody a lot of Hong Kongness. And, you know, it's telling to me that she'll also defend the rule of law, which is the same thing that a lot of protesters see themselves as protecting. And it strikes to the core, again, of the issue, which is that insofar as Hong Kong has ever had the rule of law, it is to keep Hong Kong in this paradoxical place where it doesn't actually enjoy this true autonomy and really is just a tool for faraway elites.
Can you see a finessing move by Carrie Lam, Jeremy? I mean, she's in a critical place here.
I can see her being ousted and replaced by somebody else.
Like from Beijing?
No. From, you know, another member of the Hong Kong elites.
Wanting what? Able to do what?
No, a fresh face for new repression. That's where it's going to go. I mean, I'm sorry, I can't see any good end to this. I think it's been incredibly inspiring and uplifting and extraordinary movement. As Wilfred said, these internal contradictions, the contradictions of the market and the legal regime that exists there, the nature of sovereignty, the nature of Hong Kong identity, these are extraordinarily clashing elements, and there's no simple answer, and there's no long-term resolution to things. There is individual autonomy and consciousness and social activism among the well-meaning and thoughtful people of Hong Kong who will have to live on and live through and continue to build community despite all of this.
Meantime, the American government is immensely conflicted and maybe a short-term dealer in the game. But what does the American mind matter, the American government, in not just the trade wars, but in helping or moving the Hong Kong impasse?
Well, I can't really respond.
Well, what would you be looking for? What would you be dreading? What would you be?
Well, I'm not dreading anything. I mean, the America has suffered for a very long time having a dysfunctional government under a highly erratic leadership. Doesn't help things. On one level, though, it does help in the sense that this type of erratic behavior of the Trump administration, as well as finally, some sort of will on behalf of the Senate and Congress regarding this recent law does indicate that the Chinese have to deal with something that they can't quite predict and unpredictability is what they fear the most, but they have to, and they can't handle or respond to well. So America does actually have a hand to play. Whether it is canny enough, has the political will between the legislature and the executive, I don't know.
Jeremy Barmey, I want to save the rest of our time to talk, and you won't like this, but about you and your perspective, your independence, your omniscience, your that's overstating it, but you remind me of Simon Sharma's phrase about historians drawing on the archives of the feet. You've been there. You seem to be more anthropologist and reporter at the highest level than historian, but you know all the history too. You call it the new Sinology. You're the embodiment of a different way of looking at China, and I'd love for all of us to learn something of it. Is there a 5-minute course in the new Sinology?
So what I mean by new Sinology, it's in fact something that developed in my own mind and academic practice because of my years in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a place that exemplifies. What is a new Sinology? It's a study of the Chinese world, that world that generates meaning using the elements of Chinese tradition, modernity, Western thought, and all the rest of the panoply of devices at our fingertips, and particularly using the Chinese language. But Hong Kong is an exemplification of that, a place that has elements of that relate to the grand traditions of the past, that is inherited elements of the Republican era of relative freewheeling individualism, that is inherited elements of political awareness informed by what's been going on next door in mainland China over many, many years, a place that also is where many people are also comfortable in English or in French or in various other European or regional languages, and a place that has created this particular form of Hong Kong globalized culture that we see most, you know, it's the most familiar in terms of whether it's the Jin Yong, the Jin Yong martial arts novels or martial arts movies or Hong Kong cinema and humor. It's this combination of the new and the old, the global and the local, that is at the heart of what makes Hong Kong so interesting and engaging and enthralling. Mm. And it's also something that has allowed the Chinese world to become part of a global civilization. My terms of new Sinology also relate to the fact that those who wish to engage with the contemporary People's Republic of China will have to take what the communists not only say, but what they've been doing and saying since the 1930s, building up these bodies of ideas about transforming the individual, party collectivism, neo-Stalinist, Maoist thought, Xi Jinping neoliberalism. You have to take that seriously. You have to read it not just as propaganda, but as a way of not only seeing the world, but engineering and manipulating the world and meaning and society. Now, to date, most people regard all of this sort of fluff and Xi Jinping-ism and all this stuff as just blather and vacuous, meaningless propaganda. And sorry to say, it's not. And to take it seriously, one has to put aside one's own, you know, Eurocentric, Amerocentric, or Australian-centric views of the world and treat the place more seriously. Not accept it, not accept things on the basis of what the Communist Party says, but at least to understand what it really is saying and what that might really mean.
The beauty of your perspective is that it includes the almost prehistoric Qin Dynasty, 2,000 years old and still remembered somehow in the DNA of Chinese governance, a capsule definition of that legacy in the Chinese bloodstream.
Well, it's simple, and it's not my obsession. Xi Jinping on October the 1st has published this major series of reflections on history and culture, and he talked about the Qin Dynasty. This is the first unified Chinese dynastic government of the 200 BC, which combined elements of draconian legal rule and social manipulation, and eventually formed a form of government that later on in the Han Dynasty would combine elements of Confucianism to create this surface morality with background draconian legalism to create a kind of melange of politics that in many ways Xi Jinping and his colleagues still pursue and still regard as being viable. And that's why the Qin Dynasty remains important. That's why Xi Jinping went on at great length on October the 1st talking about the Qin Dynasty and its meaning for China. That is a strong, unified government that has strict laws and regulations and highly managed, heavily managed, but also has this carapace, this surface sheen of morality and ethical behavior. And this is what they want to educate the Hong Kong people in, is how to be good citizens, to be pliant, and also to accept the moral and ethical precepts that the Communist Party lays out. And so it is this combination of legalism and Confucianism, of dynastic behavior and modern communist global neoliberalism that the Xi Jinping government wants to pursue, and that I believe a type of a new Sinology approach helps us understand better. For better or for worse, we have to deal with it.
Jeremy Barmé, you are a treat, and we want you to be in touch with us again. The Australian with the history, the variety, the energy of Hong Kong, all jumping around in your head. Thank you, Jeremy Barmé.
Chris, thank you.
Also, Wilfred Chan and Francis Hui, thank you. There's lots more material on Jeremy Barmé's website. It's called ChinaHeritage.net, a robust journal of the new Sinology that all the old China watchers read. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer, with help this week from Mike Toda. Mary McGrath is our honorary chairman. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke.
Audio Collective.